Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. According to a new biography, Brigham Young was viewed by his followers as an indispensable protector and by his opponents as a theocratic, treasonous heretic. Either way, Brigham Young left an indelible footprint on the American West. Religious studies scholar John Turner provides a somewhat provocative portrait of Young in his new biography. And today on the program, he joins us to talk about what The New Yorker is calling a definitive biography of Mormonism's greatest activist and apostle. John Turner joins me in studio. And Professor Turner, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Jennifer. I'm glad to be here.
John Turner is an assistant professor of religious studies at George Mason University. He'll be speaking about his new biography titled Brigham Young, Pioneer Prophet, this afternoon, September 11th at 4:30 at Utah State University. He'll also be speaking Thursday morning at 11 at the Charles Redd Center for Western Studies at BYU and Thursday afternoon at 5:30 at Benchmark Books here in Salt Lake City. We'll give you more details on that as we go. Later on in the program, we turn to Mars and the geology of the red planet and some similarities to Utah's red rock. But first, American Moses. What do you want to know about Brigham Young, his personality, his leadership, his controversial involvement in polygamy or the Mountain Meadow Massacre or his take on race? The list goes on. Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. John Turner, there have been several biographies of the Mormon leader Brigham Young written over the years. Why do we need a fresh look at this very complex pioneer leader?
Well, historians are a very arrogant bunch. We always think we can write a better book than what other people have done. And you're right, there have been a lot of biographies of Brigham Young. I think most of those fall into one of two camps. They're either polemical exposés of Brigham Young, or they're more parochial or hagiographic portraits of Young. And so I thought I could do something a little bit different. And also the church gave me very good access to Brigham Young's papers, which is a massive collection, 136 boxes full of all sorts of interesting things. And so I thought I could take that information, that new material, and produce a fresh look at somebody who's colorful, complex, and thrilling to study.
You say there are boxes of documents and other interesting things. What are among those artifacts that you kind of sifted through?
Sure. Well, Brigham Young's handwritten diaries were one of the first things I looked at. He kept a handwritten diary up until around 1845, and they're really hard to read. His handwriting and spelling were terrible, but they provide a very intimate look into his early years in the church. So I enjoyed looking at those. There are just stacks of letter books, letters that his office produced. Really, it goes on and on. Minutes from his sermons. He would often deliver several discourses a day, and people would take notes, and those are accessible. So there's a mountain of information out there. The real challenge was sifting through it and trying not to write a 1,000-page book.
Sure. Brigham Young has been called the American Moses, the one who led his people out of persecution on this exodus to freedom in the West. Do you think that Moses is the prophet that he most resembles?
Well, in a sense, his people did regard him as a Moses figure. Unlike Moses, he got to the promised land and had to deal with the process of settling it. So I think he's really more of a Joshua figure, somebody who actually gets there, has to deal with the people who were already here, and do the equally hard work of colonization and settlement.
Growing up in Utah, you get the impression that Brigham Young is just this super imposing figure. I mean, there's a huge monument to him on South Temple and Main Street in downtown Salt Lake City, this larger-than-life man holding his hand out. Is that an accurate physical description of Brigham Young?
Mostly. He was a barrel-chested, vigorous, sometimes athletic man. I paused a little bit because when he actually reached the Salt Lake Valley for the first time, he was recovering from a very serious illness, which is one reason he wasn't among the first group to arrive. I think he arrived a day after the first group of Mormon pioneers. But he was. He was a towering figure. I think he was physically imposing. He wasn't especially tall, but he was strong. People often have this image of Brigham Young as this gray, long-bearded old man because so many photographs that we have of him are from when he was in his 60s or closer to his death. But no, he was very active and vigorous.
Speaking with John Turner, an assistant professor of religious studies at George Mason University, his new biography is titled Brigham Young, Pioneer Prophet, and he'll be speaking about it at several events locally, one at Utah State this afternoon, also at BYU on Thursday, and at Benchmark Books here in Salt Lake City Thursday afternoon. If you'd like to join us, if you've got questions or comments about Brigham Young, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. So again, these impressions of Brigham Young as this mighty, powerful leader, I was quite surprised to read that he had very humble beginnings. He was not in the privileged class, let's say.
A really difficult upbringing and childhood. His parents were poor. They moved around a great deal. Never really managed to establish themselves. His mother died when he was 13. And his father remarried. He left home. He really had to make his own way in life. He didn't have any formal education. And it didn't seem like he was going to experience much success in his life until he joined Joseph Smith's church in 1832. And then he did have purpose and direction, and that was the purpose he headed in for the rest of his life.
He first encountered the Mormon teachings through, I believe it was a brother-in-law? Was it his brother-in-law?
Brother-in-law. Well, I think he encountered the Book of Mormon, which two different individuals shared with his family.
But prior to that, that encounter, what was his religious upbringing like, that cosmology from his childhood?
He grew up unhappily amid the Protestant evangelical revivalism of his day. In his early 20s, he joined the Methodist Church, and that conversion just didn't seem to stick. He was left unsatisfied, spiritually despondent, and so he was a seeker. He was looking for something. He prayed, he read the Bible, but nothing clicked for him, for whatever reason, until he encountered Mormonism. And it took him a couple of years to decide about that, but once he decided, he was all in.
I was going to ask you, I mean, what was the ambivalence? It did take quite some time for him to be fully converted to this new religious tradition.
Well, I think there were so many religious isms of his day. There are so many different religious groups out there that it wasn't easy to know what to believe or what to do. And he took his time thinking about it. He wasn't simply convinced after reading the Book of Mormon. What seemed to get him over the hump was seeing a group of visiting Mormon elders speak in tongues and display spiritual fire to him. And I think he took that as a clear demonstration of God's power. And that convinced him to put aside his doubts and seek baptism.
And eventually he would take up this speaking in tongues as well himself. Was that part of his earlier upbringing, or he was just familiar with it? And how does that happen?
Yeah. I don't really know how it happens. And it wasn't part of his earlier upbringing because American Protestants at that time didn't do that. Speaking in tongues was regarded as really something that was just appropriate for the very early era of Christianity and associated with very radical fringe forms of religion. So the early Latter-day Saints were very unusual in that many of them spoke in tongues. Brigham Young, a few months after he converts, he has that experience himself, And especially during his first 15 or so years in the church, it's an important part of his spirituality. He speaks in tongues. He even sings in tongues at times, which I think is pretty amazing to think about.
Can you talk about his rise to leadership within the church hierarchy?
I don't think he initially struck Joseph Smith as all that promising as a leader. He had an older brother, Joseph, and I think Joseph Smith considered Joseph Young perhaps more talented and promising. And Brigham was reserved. He wasn't used to public speaking. And I think it took him a little while to find his stride that way. But what really stood out about him from a pretty early point was his fierce loyalty and devotion to Joseph Smith. And I think it was that helped him emerge as a leader within the church. Joseph Smith, of course, recognized and valued that and appointed Brigham Young to different positions, including being one of the first 12 apostles in 1835. And as a lot of other people fell away and questioned Joseph Smith's leadership, Brigham Young did not. He stuck by his side. And so he's in a position of authority by the time Joseph Smith dies in 1844.
Yet you talk about his missionary service in Britain. Mm-hmm. Had tremendous success, mm-hmm. In part because he fully embraced the culture. He was not a strict adherent to the word of wisdom. He would go to the pubs, go to where the people were, and is that part of what made him an effective leader, was being part of the crowd?
I think so, and they were primarily ministering to very poor, working class, either urban or rural people in England, and especially that latter part, people who were poor and rural, that was Brigham Young. And so he didn't have any trouble relating to them. And no, they weren't teetotalers in terms of either alcohol or a cup of tea. In fact, when Brigham Young got back from England, he and several other men were talking about the word of wisdom, which at that point was not a strict requirement. And they were talking about whether or not it should be a strict requirement, and Brigham Young did not want to give up drinking tea. That was his position at the time. He later changed his mind about tea.
It seems to be a struggle with current Latter-day Saints about Diet Coke and tea and all that. John Turner is an assistant professor of religious studies at George Mason University. His new biography of Brigham Young is titled Brigham Young, Pioneer Prophet. He'll be speaking this afternoon, September 11th at 4:30 at Utah State University. He'll also be back on Thursday at 11 a.m. at BYU and Thursday afternoon, 5:30 p.m. at Benchmark Books. That's 3269 South Main Street here in Salt Lake City. If you'd like to join us, you can join our conversation about Brigham Young. Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Today on the program, we're talking about Brigham Young, his role in the early Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, his personality, his flaws, his leadership. A new biography explores all of these issues and more. Joining me in studio is author of the book, John Turner. He's an assistant professor of religious studies at George Mason University, and he'll be speaking about this new biography at several events throughout the week. We'll give you details on that as we go. But if you'd like to join us, if you've got questions or comments about Brigham Young and his legacy here in Utah, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Brigham Young is well known as a polygamist, and I was surprised to read that he hesitated when Joseph Smith told him, go get another wife. Was this a test of his faith? I mean, what was the hesitation there?
Well, it was such a rupture from his earlier life. He'd been married twice. His first wife died shortly after they both converted to the church back in 1832, and then he remarried 2 years later. And I'm sure he had thought about the issue of polygamy. There were all sorts of rumors about Joseph Smith. And so I don't think it would have come as a complete shock to him when Joseph Smith taught him this doctrine after he returned from England. But it's still a big turning point. You're not going to have the same life if you embrace plural marriage. You're not going to have the same marriage that you already had. And so I do think he hesitated. It's hard to reconstruct those moments, because people who did embrace plural marriage, when they talked about it retrospectively, they didn't usually say, "I was gung-ho from the start. This was great news."
Sure.
Kind of for obvious reasons, it wouldn't sound great. But I do think he hesitated. He said it was the only time in his life that he desired the grave. But he didn't hesitate all that long. He was taught the doctrine in perhaps the summer of 1841, and by the next winter, he was officiating at some of Joseph Smith's plural marriages, and he proposed plural marriage himself to a young woman in March of 1842. And after he embraced it, it's kind of like his decision to join the church. Once he was in wholeheartedly. And no one ultimately married as many women as Brigham Young in the mid-19th century.
It was something over 50 yeah. women, 50 wives. What do we know about his views toward women?
Well, they're hard to pin down. He, at various points, he would say things that were very misogynistic, that sounded kind of degrading of women. At other points, especially later in his life, he was more prone to recognize the talents of women within the church, women like Eliza Snow and Zina Huntington, both of which were among his wives. So that was kind of a mixed bag.
He married in secret, and his wife Marianne, I mean, how did she react to that?
No one knows. She publicly was supportive for at least some of the sealing. She was there as a witness and apparently giving her approval. It's hard to imagine. It wasn't incredibly difficult for her. I don't think it was easy for any women whose husbands entered into plural marriage. And so I think it was hard for her. But she didn't keep a diary or write letters about it, so we're limited in what we know.
You write that Brigham Young ascended to the top post after Joseph Smith was killed. Brigham Young became the leader of the LDS Church. And you write that gaining leadership proved more a burden than a prize for Brigham Young. What do you mean by that?
Well, he became the leader of the church at an incredibly difficult time. You know, in the wake of Joseph Smith's murder, there was a lot of uncertainty. There was uncertainty about who should leave the church. Joseph Smith hadn't left terribly clear instructions behind, and there were a number of people who stepped forward as possible leaders. Brigham Young ultimately gains the support of a majority, but not all, Latter-day Saints. But even putting that aside, the anti-Mormon forces that in many ways were responsible for Joseph Smith's demise, they're still there. And there are plenty of people in Western Illinois who don't like the presence of this huge population of Mormons. And so by the next year, there are mobs that are burning Mormon homes and settlements, and Brigham Young grudgingly agrees to leave. So he assumes leadership really at a time of crisis, and that crisis doesn't pass until they reach the Salt Lake Valley.
And yet you say that he showed his supreme skill as an organizer, as a leader during this journey west.
Yes, especially the exodus of the pioneers from winter quarters to Salt Lake, to the Salt Lake Valley in 1847.
Speaking with John Turner, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at George Mason University, author of the new biography, Brigham Young, Pioneer Prophet. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to the phones, and Sadata is calling us from Salt Lake City. Sadata, hi.
Hi, thank you for picking up my call.
Sure.
I would like to know, what has Brigham Young done that would be regarded as the greatest miracle of his lifetime?
Interesting question, Sadata. Thanks so much. What do you think, John Turner? Is there a miracle in there?
Well, that is a good question, Sadata. Thank you. I think many Latter-day Saints came to regard his assumption of church leadership in August of 1844 as a miracle. There were all sorts of reports of a miraculous transformation so that when the people looked at Brigham Young and listened to him on that day in August of 1844, they saw Joseph Smith and heard his voice. So at least according to some accounts, that was a miraculous occurrence that helped establish Brigham Young's leadership. Obviously, not everybody accepts that account, but plenty of people did.
Sadata, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. He was nicknamed the Lion of the Lord. So is this because he roared from the pulpit, or is it because he was fierce in his defense of his faith? What's the meaning behind that phrase?
Great question. I think it was his delivery of sermons. He was a very forceful speaker, and especially back in the days before microphones, that counted for a great deal. So he could make himself heard. I think that's why there's a man named William Phelps who gave each of the 12 apostles a nickname. And so he gave Brigham Young the nickname Lion of the Lord. I think that's probably what Phelps had in mind. I don't know for sure.
I thought it was interesting that you wrote, Brigham Young made no distinction between spiritual and worldly matters. So when he arrived in the Salt Lake Valley, I mean, was it his explicit intent to create a theocracy?
Well, that's a word that's so associated with something negative, but yes, in the commonsensical meaning of the word, he expected the priesthood to dictate the territory's politics and economics. And that is one reason he had so many clashes and confrontations with the U.S. government. Utah becomes a territory, which ultimately means that the president and Congress determine many of its affairs. They appoint its leaders, including Brigham Young, as its first governor. And so Brigham Young has this belief that the priesthood should rule in Utah. And Washington sees things very differently, and so there's an inevitable clash between those two points of view.
So he wants to create this safe place, a theocratic place, a place where religion is highly regarded and part of the power structure. There were already some people here, though. There were Native Americans who lived here. Do we know anything about how he viewed the inhabitants of Utah?
Sure. Well, he had been very much influenced by the Book of Mormon depiction of the Lamanites as the ancestors of Native Americans, as lapsed Israelites who needed to be restored to the true faith. And so when he was first heading west, I think he did have a missionary imperative toward the Indians in mind. And that clashed with what you might call the ugly realities of settlement. Only so many people could occupy the land. And he did very much believe that God had led the Latter-day Saints to the Salt Lake Valley and then to other parts of what became Utah. And at times he would talk about the prior inhabitants of the land as also having a claim to it, as it also being their homeland. But ultimately, he thought that it was a refuge for the Latter-day Saints, and that meant often meant pushing native peoples out of the way, and especially when there would be instances of violence between Indians and settlers. Eventually, that would sometimes push Brigham Young to order a military campaign, some of which were very bloody and ugly.
Mm. Let's go back to the phones. Mark is with us, joining us from Salt Lake City. Mark, hello.
Hi.
Hi, Mark.
How are you guys?
Hi.
I really enjoy this the topic, you know, especially the third-person narrative that you have for the whole thing. It doesn't sound like it's too personal. But that's what I'm calling about, is just why cover the subject? Why, you know, spend so much time, you know, finding out about this, you know, person that lived so long ago?
That's a good question, Mark. Thanks so much. John Turner.
Well, I guess historians are just, they're fascinated by the past and always looking for a good story and one that can be talked about in a fresh way. And Brigham Young struck me as a colorful and complex man who hadn't really received a full examination. And the fact that there were all of these wonderful and revealing sources about his life and career, really, that's what motivated me to write the biography. I had thought about writing something on Mormonism more recently. In particular, I was thinking about writing a project on Mormonism and conservative politics over the last half century.
That would have been timely.
Yeah, it would have probably been a good idea as well. But as I started reading about Mormon history, I was drawn to the 19th century. It's such a colorful time in the church's history, prophets, polygamy, persecution, and I found it irresistible. And Brigham Young appealed to me as someone who is both a towering figure in the history of American religion, but also a figure of enormous importance in the settlement of the West and in American politics more broadly in the mid-19th century.
Mark, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's go to another Mark, a different Mark, calling from Salt Lake City. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Thanks.
I'm interested in the concept of revelation. One of the pillars of the Mormon Church, as I understand it, has always been that prophets receive ongoing revelation. But there was really, in my view, a change from Brigham Young, from Joseph Smith's time. Brigham Young didn't add to the Doctrine and Covenants in any significant way. And I've seen quotes where he actually said he couldn't really live up to the mantle that Joseph Smith had laid with regard to speaking with God on a regular basis. And I'm interested in what your view is on whether he felt like he was actually talking to God on a regular basis, and why didn't he add to the Doctrine and Covenants like Joseph Smith did?
Interesting question, Mark. Thanks so much. I mean, was he an accidental prophet, do you think, John Turner? Or did he feel like he really had this direct connection with the deity?
Well, there are a lot of different questions within that question. That's wonderful, Mark. Thank you. I think when he first assumed leadership of the church, he did, to some extent, feel inadequate as a prophet. I think a lot of Latter-day Saints expected him to act more like Joseph Smith and to dictate written revelations in particular. That's what people had grown to expect.
New scripture.
Yeah, written down. Mm-hmm. And with a handful of exceptions, Brigham Young doesn't do that, which I actually think was one of the reasons for his success. He didn't try to baldly imitate Joseph Smith. He didn't try to be Joseph Smith. I think that was smart. It did leave an opening for other would-be prophets who did write revelations and act more like Joseph Smith. But I think he was smart not to do that. He did very much claim, though, that he was the church's revelatory leader. And I think as his life progressed, he was more comfortable seeing himself as a prophet. Even he would sometimes talk about himself in self-deprecating terms along those lines. He once called himself a Yankee guesser rather than a prophet. But he very much claimed that he had revelations, that in fact the people should regard all of his words as revelations. It wouldn't just be particular written, dictated revelations, but his day-to-day advice they should interpret as God's instructions to them.
Mark, thanks so much for that call. Let's go to Heidi. Heidi's joining us from Salt Lake City. Heidi, hello.
Good morning. This is a great topic, very interesting, and I have so many questions, but I'm just going to narrow it down to three. I was wondering if Brigham Young, with all his plural wives, were they all physically living with him at various times, or were most of them or some of them spiritual wives for another world? And then also, what was his view about women blessing their children when the priesthood was not around? I've heard stories about that. And did he condone it? Was he aware of it? Was that something he supported? And then my last question, is he the one also responsible for assigning the saints, once they got to Salt Lake, to be the ones would be Democrats and the twos would be Republicans, so that they would be evenly split?
Interesting questions, Heidi. Thank you so much for the call. You're going to have to keep the answer short, though.
Sure.
First, where did his wives live?
Can I take them in reverse order?
Yes, absolutely.
The last one's really easy. No, he's not responsible for that.
The political division?
Yeah, there was just a People's Party, which was the kind of the Mormon party toward the end of his life. But early on in the 1850s, 1860s, all church members voted basically for the church ticket that the hierarchy settled on. So that one was easy. Let me take then the first one. Did he live with all of his wives, or were some of them, you know, were really just spiritual wives? It's a great diversity of experiences. If you're in Salt Lake City, you're familiar with the Lion House, which was directly adjacent to Brigham Young's own mansion, personal residence. He lived with one wife in his personal residence, and then at various times, 14, 16 wives lived in the Lion House. He also built homes for several other wives in different communities around Utah. Some of them simply couldn't stand communal living and wanted to be on their own, and he tended to oblige them. Not all of those 50-plus wives even came to Utah. In some instances, they remained with prior husbands, or they simply didn't choose to travel west. So there were a lot of different outcomes. I think he had, close ongoing sorts of relationships with around 25 of those women.
Wow, that's a lot of work. We've only got a couple of minutes to go. I can't let you go without mentioning the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And for those who don't know, a group of Mormons posed as, I believe it was Paiutes. They ambushed a wagon train and slaughtered men, women, and children. It's been a subject of much speculation over the years whether or not Brigham Young had ordered the Mormons to intervene with this wagon train and to actually kill people. You come down on the side that he did not specifically order the massacre, at this particular massacre, but that you say he, quote, bears significant responsibility for what took place there. What leads you to believe his significant responsibility in Mountain Meadows?
Sure. Well, and first of all, listeners might want to know that the massacre took place exactly 155 years ago on this date. So that's a timely question. I don't think that it's hard to answer your question in a few minutes.
I apologize.
No, that's fine. it was a wartime climate as of September 1857. A U.S. Army was marching on Utah. Brigham Young had galvanized his people to resist that army, and there was a great amount of anti-Gentile sentiment in the territory. Brigham Young was also encouraging Utah's Indians to feel free to attack wagon trains and to get ready to fight on the side of the Mormons. And then there's this massacre in southern Utah. I come down, like you said, on the side of Brigham Young not specifically ordering it. It's hard to make sense of the massacre. On the one hand, his ultimate goal was to keep a U.S. Army out of the valley. To have authorized the massacre would have produced a military response from Washington that might have annihilated the church. On the other hand, it's hard to understand how Mormon settlers in the South would do something like this without his authorization. I think in the end, the best evidence that's available to us suggests that he didn't order it, but without his wartime leadership, I don't think something like this could have taken place.
We'll have to leave it there. John Turner, an assistant professor of religious studies at George Mason University. Professor Turner, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Jennifer.
John Turner will speak about the new biography, Brigham Young, Pioneer Prophet, this afternoon, September 11th at 4:30 p.m. at Utah State University. He'll also be speaking Thursday morning, 11 o'clock, at the Charles Redd Center for Western Studies at BYU, and then Thursday afternoon, 5:30 p.m. at Benchmark Books, 3269 South Main Street here in Salt Lake City. There's more detail on our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, why Mars matters. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City.